Our next case for argument is 25-1624, Epic Tech versus Penn Tech Associates. Mr. Lehrer, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, we're respectfully asking this Court to reverse the District Court's denial of sanctions against both Epic Tech and Baker Donaldson. Penn Tech's three sanction motions were predicated entirely on ineligibility of the patent at suit, and Epic Tech and Baker Donaldson's knowledge of the same. The District Court ruling should also be reversed because it based its entire ruling on the unrelated issues of infringement. In addition, the District Court applied the wrong law when requiring a finding of bad faith to show exceptionality. It ignored the weakness of Epic Tech's case.
Did you move to dismiss the complaint or move for judgment on the pleadings based on the Section 101 argument?
No, we did not.
Why not?
At the time, I was not lead counsel, and lead counsel decided it was a better path to go for a go via the patent office path to try to get the patent invalidated based on a reexamination.
Well, given that you had not availed yourself of those opportunities to seek dismissal of the case and that these issues arose on summary judgment, I mean, isn't that a factor that the District Court could have considered in deciding that sanctions were not warranted?
In the old law, that would have been true. However, under Rule 11, the safe harbor letter is what is the important factor here. And we provided that safe harbor letter to Epic Tech, and they ignored it. The one issue that we're talking about as far as sanctions is motive and mens rea, which we were not aware of until the end of the case when we found out that both Epic Tech and Baker Donaldson failed to perform an eligibility investigation prior to filing suit, even though it had been told on numerous occasions that the identical claims were invalid or were ineligible under the new Alice standard.
Given the presumption of validity, why should patentees be required to perform that kind of analysis on what has been defined as an affirmative defense?
So not all patentees should be required to do that. The presumption is a rebuttable presumption, and based on the Rule 11 requires an investigation based on the circumstances, reasonable under the circumstances. In this particular case, you have a patent that issued in 2013, you have the Supreme Court Alice case, which fundamentally changed the test for eligibility that was ruled on a year later in 2014. Between 2014 and 2020, when Epic Tech and Baker Donaldson filed suit, there were three occasions where the U.S. Patent Office specifically identified patently indistinct claims from those of the 317 patent as ineligible, as both patently indistinct from the claims of the 317 patent and ineligible under the new Alice standard. They provided both claim charts showing the correlating the claims of the continuation applications to the claims of the 317 patent, and they provided an analysis of why those claims didn't pass the Alice test.
Often refer to it as kind of the Mayo Alice test. Have you ever heard the court referring to it in that context?
As the Mayo? No, I have not.
Okay. So I was just saying, are you aware that Mayo issued earlier than Alice? Okay. So given that sort of context, does that change your argument in terms of saying you're really pitting a stake in the sand saying that Alice completely changed the standard? If you view it as kind of the Mayo Alice test, is 2014 necessarily the year that you have to pit all of your eggs in one basket? I know I'm mixing some metaphors, but
Alice redefined the test. It basically made it more of a definitive test, and it It is the 2014 date because that's the date that all of the future cases relied on. Yes, Mayo was similar. It didn't go as far as Alice did. And the Patent Office was not, rejecting claims as ineligible under Mayo for the same reasons that it was rejecting claims under Alice.
Do you have any case law that supports it being an abuse of discretion to not impose attorney's fees in this sort of situation?
I'm sorry, to not impose?
To not impose attorney's fees in this sort of situation.
There is no specific case law that states that it would be an error to not impose sanctions. However, this case is very specific to the facts of this case, which is that, as I said, the patent issued a year before Alice, after Alice, on three separate occasions prior to filing suit, the Patent Office informed the plaintiff and its attorneys who were actually prosecuting the applications on behalf of the plaintiff at the Patent Office that the claims at issue had a problem under the new Alice test, and therefore they were required to perform an ineligibility analysis prior to asserting an ineligible patent and verifying to the court that the patent was valid and enforceable.
You can keep going.
Okay, sorry. excuse me. So Epic Tech filed suit against Pentek alleging infringement of the 317 patent, knowing that the claims of the 317 patent were directed to ineligible subject matter under 35 U.S.C. 101. As I said, on three separate occasions prior to filing suit, the U.S. Patent Office rejected claims that were patently indistinct from the claims of the 317 patent and ineligible under the new Alice standard. With that knowledge, a reasonable attorney would have performed the Alice two-part test on the claims of the 317 patent, and as the Patent Office determined, would have determined that the claims were ineligible. Epic Tech's attempt to reliance on the statutory presumption of validity should be rejected as mere sophistry. The presumption is not a license to disregard specific knowledge. Rule 11 asks whether the attorney's legal arguments are warranted after an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances. Here, the pre-filing circumstances where you had a patent that issued prior to Alice, you had multiple patent office rejections saying that the claims in the continuation applications were identical to the claims of the 317 patent and did not pass the new test.
And the district court considered that, right? The district court considered the PTO rejections as well as the decision in Fusion Skill and said, I hear you, I see these, but I don't want to put a decisive weight on these authorities because of the potential implications on that for other cases and the fact that they were different claims than those asserted in the case, right?
So there are multiple aspects to your question.
Start with the district court did address both those things, right?
It incorrectly addressed them. It addressed the fact that the Fusion Skill court addressed the case and found the claims to be invalid. It addressed the fact that the Patent Office rejected claims in a later filed application as ineligible under Alice. But then it relied on infringement law to decide that it wasn't going to make a leap to provide notice because a later filed claim cannot go back and change the scope of a previously issued claim. We never made that argument. We never argued that the prosecution history of the three continuation applications changed the scope of the 317 patent. All we said was that they provided objective notice to the plaintiff and to Baker Donaldson, who was prosecuting these applications, that there was an issue with the claims of the 317 patent that needed to be resolved based on Rule 11 prior to filing suit. They did no investigation of their own.
What is your best case support for the argument that they need to do a full-blown pre-suit investigation with respect to 101?
I don't know that I necessarily have a best case for that. Basically, Rule 11 itself says that Rule 11 says that you need to do a reasonable investigation under the circumstances. The circumstances, and I apologize, I forget the case that says that the minimum requirement is an infringement investigation. The key word there is minimum requirement, not every requirement.
Are you referring to the Q Pharma case?
Yes, thank you. So that's the minimum requirement. No one argues they did their infringement analysis. No one's arguing that they didn't. What they didn't do is they didn't do an investigation as to the eligibility of the claims, even though they were put on notice multiple times that an issue existed. Now, they can't rely on their expert report that was created, frankly, was created for the Fusion Skill case, multiple years after filing the case, because number one, that doesn't retroactively create a pre-suit investigation. And number two, the Fusion Skill Court had already rejected that opinion as not reliable because it added elements to the claims and it added disclosure into the specification that didn't exist.
So you said you couldn't give me your best case. Do you have any case you could give me? I'll take any.
Well, I guess the case that you just mentioned.
Well, the Q Pharma one that right. You said, but it referred to infringement. I'm wanting any case you can give me where it says the pre-suit investigation would have to encompass a Section 101 analysis.
Unfortunately, this is an issue of first impression because the facts of this case are very specific to this particular plaintiff. This particular plaintiff was aware that their patent issued before Alice. This particular plaintiff and their counsel tried on numerous occasions to get identical claims issued in additional patents. The specific reason that double patenting exists is so a patentee can't get multiple patents on the same invention. By providing 35 U.S.C. 132 provides that a patent office action puts the plaintiff or the patentee on notice of why their claims are not eligible for patenting. And in this case, the patent office did that on at least three separate occasions prior to Epic Tech filing suit. Now, post-filing suit, they also received numerous notices that the claims were invalid, which they also ignored. They had the Fusion Skill Court, which invalidated substantively identical claims.
Counsel, do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Sure, yes.
All right, let's save some.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure. Is it Crosby?
Yes, ma'am.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Clint Crosby along with Tyler Bishop here for Epic Tech LLC. This Court should affirm the determination of Judge Calvert and the trial court that the facts presented below did not authorize or require a finding of sanctions against either Epic Tech or Baker Donaldson. As the Court has seen, Pentec made four attempts at that under Section 285, under Rule 11, under 1927, and the Court's inherent authority. And Judge Calvert, in her 21-page opinion, went thoroughly through all the facts presented below, went thoroughly through the law that was argued to her by Pentec as well as Epic Tech, and made a determination.
Counsel, is it your view that the presumption of validity insulates a patentee from ever having to think through or analyze the validity of their patent before asserting it?
No, Your Honor. The 282 is the statutory presumption. It requires clear and convincing evidence of whoever wants to overcome that presumption, in this case, Pentec. And it is an insulating layer, if you will, but it is not.
Well,
it is
an insulating layer. So is it your view that the presumption of validity standing alone insulates your client from the obligation to do any sort of assessment of the validity of its own patent prior to bringing a suit?
No, Your Honor. We would not argue that 282 is an absolute bar. Certainly if a patentee has, you know, I think the inventor holdings case is what's instructive from this court, which the court limited that facts, you know, limited that case to its facts and said what the court there was trying to do was trying to prevent frivolous lawsuits. And under its analysis under 285, we want to look at the facts and the law to determine if we need to prevent those frivolous claims.
What any investigation did you establish that your client did prior to filing the lawsuit with regard to validity of its patent? Did you offer any evidence of investigation that you did prior to filing this lawsuit?
Your Honor, no, there was no evidence presented in this case as far as an invalidity analysis. And as the court found below and counsel has conceded, there is no determination of what that invalidity analysis would be or how you would present it.
What did the district court then, the district court made a finding that this case is not exceptional, despite ultimately concluding the patent was invalid. Now, not every invalid patent is wrongfully enforced, but what was the district court's precise reasoning? And I'm going to ask you to point me to the page number where I can see it. The district court's precise reasoning that articulates why it concluded there was no error, no problem with you asserting this particular patent in light of its ultimate determination that that patent was invalid. So what precisely did this district court say that would help me understand how it concluded this case was not exceptional in light of the invalidity of this patent?
Your Honor, I think the best examples are at Appendix 17 and 18, and really throughout the opinion, Judge Calvert.
No, not throughout it. I want page and line number. I want you to read me where I can understand that this district court thoughtfully considered the question of whether the validity in this case rose to the level of exceptionality. Because I think this is a particularly bad patent. But I'm of course looking at that with the benefit of hindsight of many years of now seeing bad patents like this. And so this was filed in 2020. So I'm looking at this opinion carefully because I've got to give a lot of deference to this district court judge and I'm fully prepared to do that. But I want to see where the analysis demonstrates to me, that this district court judge came to some sort of reasoned conclusion about why this very bad patent, my words, nonetheless doesn't rise to the level of a frivolous assertion.
Your Honor, at page 13, the court determines in the first paragraph that it had granted granted the motion for summary judgment invalidating the patent, but it had considered the vacation and fusion skill as well as the prior opinions as persuasive authority, but declines to go further.
Why? I'm sorry. Once again, what in the world does this tell me about what the district court concluded was sufficient on your part to allow you to assert this patent?
The court concluded that based on the affidavit that we submitted under Q Pharma, that Jason Queen had observed this infringing accused product in practice.
That's infringement, sir. That has nothing to do with validity. I'm trying to get you to focus on validity. What did this district court, I'm looking and I'm having a hard time finding anything in this opinion that articulates for me the rationale behind this district court's decision that this patent, which so clearly fails the Alice test to me, it was still reasonable for you to assert it in light of that. That's what I'm struggling with. Not whether they might be infringing. Grant you that. Don't care about that. But what I'm focused on is validity. You asserted a bad patent. So where is the analysis the district court gave me that allows me to say, yes, I will defer to that. I will defer to that particular fact finding or that particular assessment.
Your Honor, we asserted a patent that was presumed valid under 282.
Is your fallback on presumption of validity? And you said no.
As counsel has admitted, when asked what is the case law that outlines what this invalidity determination is, when it's supposed to be utilized, and how it's supposed to be submitted, counsel admitted it does not exist. What Q Pharma says was that you have to interpret the patent and apply it to the claims.
I'm going to ask you one more time. Where can I find in the district court's opinion something, some fact-finding, some analysis that explains to me how the district court concluded, on validity only, that that it was okay for you to assert this patent?
Your Honor, I've given you the best reference from the order that I can.
Well, let me ask you this question. The invalidity issue was resolved on cross motions for summary judgment, and that's in a separate opinion.
Now, that's correct.
If we were to look at that opinion, would it reflect that the district court found that the invalidity issue, although resolved in the defendant's favor, had issues going both ways? Meaning that is that what we would find if we went to docket 143 that's referenced here?
Your Honor, I think it's the similar recitation that we have in the order that we're dealing with here. To be clear, there was not an invalidity declaration, or there was not an additional piece of evidence that was submitted. The court considered what was presented to it, which was under the guise of 282, the presumed validity, and it looked at every attack that there was to that patent via the patent office or fusion skill and said, that does not invalidate this patent. I mean, that's the analysis that the court conducted. That's the analysis that was before the court, those particular facts. And as counsel has admitted and the panel has questioned, there is no law that requires different or additional.
Because, as he said, it's a case of first impression. I think it's a case of first impression. But do you have a case that says otherwise? Where is your case that says I cannot reconsider a district court decision which doesn't touch with specificity on these facts in making a determination? Where is your case to the contrary? Do you have one?
The instructor.
Tell me the name of it.
The Inventor Holdings versus Bed Bath & Beyond case, Your Honor, is the closest one that we have to these facts.
And what does it say?
But this court limited it to its facts and said expressly that where it had asserted claims in the Alice case came out later, and the court determined that the claims asserted by Inventor Holdings likely were invalid before Alice, that then it obligated Inventor Holdings to have undertaken an additional analysis of its case or claims. We don't have that situation here. We were already on file. There's been no change in the law, but there is no case that says there's a separate invalidity determination that has to be done. As stated with Judge Cunningham, Q Pharma is the instructive case.
Well, I don't see how Q Pharma clearly governs this set of facts. So basically you keep saying he didn't cite to me a case that helps him win. You didn't cite to me a case that helps you win. I don't think there's a case on this point. Here are the facts as I see them. You got a patent before Alice came out. Alice came out and it changed the legal landscape in substantial ways. Anybody that says otherwise is just crazy. So Alice changed the legal landscape in substantial ways. And then the PTO three times over rejected relatively similar, not identical claims, but relatively similar claims of yours in continuation applications that I think should have clearly put you on notice that you have a big, fat Alice problem with these claims. And yet, despite that, fast forward 6 more years, during which time the Federal Circuit has issued many, many, many opinions relying on Alice, which has struck down claims exactly like yours. And yet you enforce this patent against somebody. You go out and sue somebody. And you're telling me, but we had a presumption of validity. I think that is a case of first impression as I see it. And my problem is I don't see the district court judge to have dealt with it. I see this district court judge to have written some cursory things, which maybe are just barely enough. I don't know. But that's what I'm struggling with. So respond to that, please.
Your Honor, in this court, as you're representing, in American Axle versus NECO, has stated that this court has struggled with the vagaries of Alice. Certainly, the office has struggled with the vagaries. I believe the office that issued at least 5 sets of guidance on how to take Alice and apply it to claims. So one rejection of a claim at the patent office, certainly maybe it raises a question, but it is not a presumption.
Three. You didn't have one, you had 3. You had 3 separate rejections at the patent office of very, very similar claims.
One or 3 does not reach back and invalidate a prior issued patent. That simply is not the law.
Put you on notice that maybe you gotta take a look, and you can't just rely on that presumption.
Well, certainly, Your Honor. Let's take that presumption from there. It puts on notice and an Alice, evaluation is made or what have you. And the determination is that, well, with the presumption of validity, this is a patent that is able to move forward.
I'm just gonna tell you right now, if I were the district court judge in this case, I 100% would have granted the attorney's fees. I think this is an exceptional case. I'm not a district court judge. So what you have to do to convince me not to overturn this district court judge who I think got that wrong is show me in this opinion where she said something that is worthy of being deferred to, because I'll defer to just about anything. I'll defer to a district court judge because that's what you should do. She heard the whole case, not me. But I'm really struggling with seeing where she analyzed what I just laid out in front of you.
Your Honor, as you've stated, this court gives great deference to the trial courts that lived with, I believe, this case for 5+ years. And Judge Calvert had the case at summary judgment.
In her opinion, either this opinion or some other opinion. I think Judge Subramanian tried to help you pivot to a different opinion. You sort of swung and missed when he handed you a softball, but I'm going to give you another shot at it. Here's another softball. Show me another opinion where maybe she said something.
Let me throw you another pitch. So there was
use. He's underhanding this one. He might actually roll it to you.
You submitted an expert or report in accompanying the motions for summary judgment, right? And presumably your expert reached the conclusion that these patents were valid and under the Alice test, right?
Judge Submarini, thank you for that. Yes.
Okay.
Ivan Zakovich.
If I went and looked at the district court's analysis of that expert opinion, would there be anything in your favor? Or did the court say, this is a stinky expert opinion, get it out of here, and so it doesn't really help you?
It is an unexcluded opinion. Judge Calvert did consider it as part of summary judgment. There were expert opinions from both sides, and Mr. Zakovich opined that the 317 patent was valid and infringed. So there is...
You're not answering his question either. Did she rely on it? Is there anything in her opinion you can point us to that demonstrates that she said, that was an expert report, and maybe it provided some reasonable basis for you all to proceed on this lawsuit?
It was presented to her as part of the motion for sanctions and cited. She does not cite any expert opinion in her order.
So given all of that, why wouldn't the best course be to vacate and remand so that Judge Calvert, in the first instance, can look to see if there are arrows pointing in your favor that would militate against either attorney's fees or would suggest that at the threshold of the case, you satisfied your Rule 11 obligations?
Your Honor,
without reaching any conclusions on our end, but leaving it to Judge Calvert with some guidance to consider those facts.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's the deference that's normally afforded trial courts in these circumstances, and we're at an abuse of discretion standard. You know, did she, Judge Calvert, fail to consider law and fail to consider the facts? And as Your Honor has pointed out, vis-a-vis her order on the sanctions, as well as orders on summary judgment, which are in the record below, she fully considered all of the facts. There's nothing "quote unquote" new to consider. In her order, I mean, you know, she goes very clearly and says, "I look closely at the pieces from the from the patent office and from FusionSkill, and there is no law has been cited or anything to her to pressure her that meant she had to award sanctions." But she was, again, it's a thoughtful, well laid out, opinion and order that did not grant sanctions. And the court should affirm that under the abuse of discretion standard and affirm the order of the trial court.
Counsel, maybe give me one.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
I was going to give you one last shot. Do you want one last shot or?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay. Besides pointing us to the pages that you discussed with my colleagues in this particular order, which I think you point us to pages 13 and 17, is there anything else that you could point us to in terms of consideration of the potential invalidity or validity of the patent?
By Judge Calvert here, Your Honor, in this order?
I you can give me another order. I gave you a chance here to be like, you got to join the appendix. I'd be thrilled with any page that you want to point us to beyond just the two pages. Or is this all you want us to leave this room on?
Well, I don't have the direct cite here to the summary judgment briefing, but she took up the
450. I'll give you the direct cite. Go get it. Pick up your appendix. It's page 450. That is her order. Like, see if you can find something there. I would love. I'm giving you the opportunity to not lose your case. Get your appendix and try and not lose your case.
We can pull that up, Your Honor. Apologies. Your Honor, I'd bring the printed appendix, so it's going to take a moment. Apologies.
Do you have the printed appendix?
I don't have it with me. No, with travel restrictions, we weren't able to bring that in printed format. Apologies.
Okay. I have been a lawyer before I was a judge, and you could, of course, ship printed materials, which I would recommend to counsel because it's easier than trying to boot up a computer with, like, no time left in your argument.
Understood, Your Honor.
No? Okay, why don't we move on and hear some rebuttal? You've got a minute and 57 seconds.
I need about 5 seconds. I have nothing further to say.
Smart.
I have nothing further to say. I could not articulate the issues any better than Your Honors.
That. Okay, thank you very much. This case is taken under submission.